Please be seated. Parables. Despite the many lyrical and thoughtful books written on the topic, they continue to be somewhat of a mystery. Every generation has had different interpretations. Luke's versions of Jesus' parables are perhaps the most evocative. It's almost possible to believe one is just peeking around the corner to catch a glimpse of the crowds as they listen to it for the first time. However, there is something about the parable today that just doesn't seem to be a similar case. Suffice to say, if it troubles you, you're not alone. Even Phyllis Tickle entitled an article, "Oh No, Don't Tell Me the Parable of the Dishonest Manager Has Come Round Again," obviously also not the favorite of preachers. But she does pose an important question about this parable, which covers also other parables. And she asks this: where through the centuries did we come up with the notion, now firmly fixed in millions of Christian heads, that since God and the rich man are the same in our minds, we have to go through contortions to justify or excuse God for some kind of moral failing that may or may not be evident in the wealthy man's reactions? I imagine you've wondered that yourselves, just a little. At best, this parable is a conundrum, and at worst, it seems to push the notion of a God who can be both cruel and whimsical, manipulating the manager and the situation. Sadly, a natural corollary seems to be that humans must themselves then be capricious in dealing with such a God. It's not hard to see the effect this could have in creating the health and wealth gospel lifestyle and theology. God is contained and easy to manipulate in our favor. But let's put this here for now. I also came across another commentator who calls this parable the taming of the shrewd. The taming of the shrewd. No matter what your 21st century thoughts of that Shakespearean play that you just thought of might be, it too is filled with contortions of forcing people into ill-fitting roles. The characters seem to comply, apparently fearful of painful losses if they do not. Even their own identities are at risk. So with all of this floating around, I was reminded of a coffee shop encounter. It had been quite rainy, something like today, and after visiting galleries and museums, we had developed a bad case of museum feet. We needed a coffee. The closest we could find was a Starbucks, imagine, in central London. Really, a Starbucks. Others had had the same idea, and we gratefully sank into the last available seats. The table that we had found was quite close to another, and we, in true Canadian style, apologized for intruding and sat down. The possessor of the other table was a man who looked to be the epitome of a financier. Shiny briefcase, impeccably tailored suit with crisp shirt and tie. Cell phone carefully placed on the table. That's where the focus was. And it was clear from the accumulated coffee cups he had been there for some time. The attention to his cell phone seemed to indicate he was involved in important business. The ruse ended when he admitted that his phone had run out of battery. We discussed charging options and a conversation began. He had been in middle management in a large financial institution that eventually crumbled from the ripple effects of the banking crisis in 2008. He remained angry, resigned, and certain. He maintained that the financial model of his former employer was the only reasonable way to do business. All he needed to do was massage the system in order to return to work. But he did admit that his commitment to this perspective had contributed to the end of his marriage and the loss of home and family. Starbucks was now his office. Was he and his attitudes representative of those who work in national and global finance? Was his ethical norm that of others? His approach did seem to be a narcissistic one, unimpeded by ethics or compassion. He'd been creative when his job was threatened, but he lost it anyway. Now all he had to do was sharpen his game, and all would be well. He was unable to comprehend that if he was feeling lost, vulnerable, and isolated, so were those whom the corporate acts of financial manipulation had injured. He too was a member of the ranks of those who were failed by the system, the institution, the leaders and managers, like himself. My take on this is that this young man's story is a modern version of this parable. He would have applauded the actions of the manager. After all, he could see himself doing something similar. He could be shrewd. He could demonstrate his usefulness to the owner. And in the parable, like the young man's story, neither the rich landowner nor the manager questioned the system which saw such machinations as the norm. The pattern of Jesus' teachings in the gospel demonstrates time and again how people had lost perspective. He reminded those in power, religious and political leaders, the wealthy and the poor, of how they were to value and have compassion for each other. So it makes sense there would be a parable to challenge beliefs in economic power and usurious structures. So let's come back to ourselves in this moment in time. We too ought to some degree have been acculturated to think of basic economics as a type of universal truth. Yet the systems, the gods we have trusted, are faulty. And Jesus did say, we serve only one God. So if we looked at our relationships, our understanding of how financial systems work, and I can't claim to understand that, but I do know that there was an article from an economics professor from UBC who says, there is an error when we compare family financial reality to governmental and larger institutions. That's another topic. This parable affirms that our values should not be based on power or economic manipulation. Sadly, the man in the coffee shop could not yet bring himself to consider that as an option. One cannot help but see the relationship between this parable and our growing awareness of the impact on creation of economic theory and practice, the misuse of wealth, relationships, and resources. We see the phenomenon that goes back to the life that's been generated through teenager Greta Thunberg a challenge which cuts across fondly held beliefs and power. Green architect, engineer, and faithful Christian, Albert Baikal said, "Climate change is akin to cancer. We won't treat it until we see it. We won't treat it until we see it." He admits that what motivates his work locally and internationally is the hope to be part of the change for a world which will be livable for his 6-year-old daughter. And the larger question remains, how do systems of power and privilege become sensitive to the needs of everyone in the village, the city, the nation, or the world? Are decisions to be made solely on the basis of economic values and biases? Are they to be made solely on the basis of growth and budgetary logic? Jesus reminds us that no matter the era, no matter the immense growth in information and knowledge, we have lost our way. It comes back to the grandly unsimple question, what is of greatest value? What are we prepared to relinquish in order to step outside systems that tie us to a kind of subservience which is not of God? Asking that question takes us down the path where we begin to become able to see the necessity of caring for creation. But that's not altogether enough. We need to truly see ourselves living within creation, not separate from it, loving, caring, valuing, and nurturing, creating moments of harmony and compassion where the potential is beyond the systems that used to define us. No longer tamed into destructive roles, but freely entering into relationships with each other and the Creator. It can look like messing about in the dirt, admiring the symmetry of dahlias and acorns, listening as pebbles tell their story, and joyfully growing relationships, whether with a pebble or a person. Amen.